Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Since 22-year-old Elliot Roger killed six people on a recent rampage near Santa Barbara, we've been grappling with the effects of gender-based violence in our society. We did two shows last week, and we had so many calls about this. So we decided to do another show to focus on these issues, specifically with men. One of today's guests, Jackson Katz, says calling gender violence a women's issue is part of the overall problem. He says we need to be asking what's going on with men. So on today's Your Call, we're focusing on the socialization of men and boys. How can they actively participate in ending misogyny and gender-based violence? And then the larger questions, how should we talk to men and boys about issues like sexism, anger, rejection, pornography, and the objectification of women? How can we go deeper when we're talking about these issues? Today, we are joined by Quentin Walcott, co-executive director of Connect New York City, an organization dedicated to eliminating family violence. An anti-violence activist and educator, Quentin has spent the last 18 years addressing a critical part of the equation to stop violence against women, and that is men. He's also worked with Eve Ensler to help facilitate and launch V-Men programming in New York, and he joins us from his office in New York. Hi, Quentin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. I want to ask you first about the framing of this conversation. Jackson Katz, who's going to join us a little later in the show, says part of the problem is that we call these issues women's issues, and that turns off men immediately. He says even the word gender tends to turn men off. Do you agree with that?
I agree, just with other forms and other isms. Like if you talk about racism, you automatically think black, or you think, you know, gender, you think women. And it's a reality that, you know, most of the violence that's being committed is by men and boys. So it's important to frame it in a way where it's where we're looking at male violence. And then also in terms of the remedy of it, so it's important that men and women are allying to really interrupt these cycles of violence. But ultimately, it is a community issue. So, but it's important to kind of go through those steps and really claiming it as a men's issue.
And also, the other issue here is that when we talk about it as a woman's issue, men tend to be largely erased from the conversation because they feel like they're just not part of it, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and you know, violence is unacceptable no matter who does it. But the one interesting thing about male violence as well is that men will probably three times more susceptible to male violence than actually women are. So it's important that we really break down what this violence is and how we form these attitudes and belief systems that say it's okay to be violent.
That is Quentin Walcott, co-executive director of Connect NYC, an organization dedicated to eliminating family violence. And now I would like to welcome Jackson Katz to the show. Jackson is co-founder of Mentors in Violence Prevention, which introduced the bystander approach to the sexual assault and relationship abuse prevention fields. We'll talk to him about that today. MVP is taught in colleges, high schools, professional and amateur sports, and the U.S. and Australian militaries. Jackson is author of the book, The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help. And he joins us from Long Beach. Hi, Jackson. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much for having me on.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Byron Hurt, an award-winning documentary filmmaker, writer, and anti-sexist activist. A former Northeastern University football quarterback, Byron he's a founding member of the Mentors in Violence program. He also served as associate director of the first gender violence prevention program in the U.S. Marines. His documentary films include I Am a Man, Black Masculinity in America, and Hip Hop, Beyond Beats and Rhymes. His next film is called Hazing, How Badly Do You Want In? It'll focus on the hotly debated topic of hazing in frats and sororities, sports teams, and the military. He's currently running an Indiegogo campaign to raise money for this documentary, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Byron. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're really glad that all of you are on because we did a show about these issues last week, and so we got so many phone calls, and we don't want this conversation to die down. So, Jackson, I want to ask you, I recently watched your TED Talk, and I spoke about this a bit with Quentin, but you really raise this point and say we need to change the framing because the way that it's framed now, focusing on women and gender, we exclude men from the conversation. So what's the best way to bring as many men as possible into this conversation?
Well, thanks, Rose. One you know, conceptual shift that needs to happen is, I just heard Q say this, is we need to understand these are not just women's issues that some good men help out with, which is the frame that most people have today. That's the status quo of most people's thinking. Instead of seeing it in that way, I think the frame, we need to see these as men's issues as well as women's issues. And then people will say, well, what do you have to, why do you have to say men's issues and women's issues? Why can't you just say they're, you know, community issues, human rights issues, public health issues, social justice issues? But all of that degendered language keeps to conspires to keep the status quo in place, which is men check out. Men think it's not our issue. Men think that the word gender equals women. Men think that these are concerns for women, and that, yeah, if I'm a good guy, I'm going to help some women. I'm going to write a check for this battered women's program or sexual assault program. I'm going to listen to my girlfriend. If, you know, if I'm a heterosexual guy with a girlfriend or a wife, I'm going to listen to her a little better. And that's not the change that really needs to happen. The change has to be much more fundamental than that, and it needs to engage men at all levels of social and, you know, political, cultural influence, not just, excuse me, not just 20-year-old college students or you know, or 27-year-old, you know, men. It needs to be powerful men in you know, politics and business and labor unions. Men in positions of institutional leadership need to see these as our issues, and cultural influence need to see these as our issues. And until that day, until that happens, we're just cleaning up after the fact. And we have a small number of men who are politicized, educated, and supporting women and women's organizations. And yet the problems are so systematic and so deep, and they're so global, and they're so, in some cases, complicated, in other cases, not so complicated. But we need a whole lot more emphasis on them. And that this conceptual shift that I'm talking about, seeing them as men's issues and leadership issues for men, and that piece needs to precede any of the other micro changes that have to happen all over.
Byron, can you give us some specific examples of what a conversation sounds like with, let's talk about boys first. How do you get boys to really take these issues seriously?
Well, I think you have to get young men to a place where they can humanize girls and women and see how these issues are important to them and also affect them. As Quentin mentioned, you know, Jackson and I worked together for many, many years with the Mentors in Violence Prevention Program, working in classrooms, even in hockey locker rooms, and working with football players and basketball players, men of all different races and ethnic and cultural backgrounds. And, you know, the difficulty is preventing men from denying the issue, that this is an issue, and also deflecting the issue back onto women and basically blaming women for their own problems or issues, and not taking ownership or not taking accountability for our role in such a high level of physical and sexual violence against girls and women. And so the conversation has to be very honest. It has to be very forthright. I think, you know, what I try to do as a facilitator when I'm in a room is to really speak as honestly and openly about the ways in which I was socialized and conditioned as a man, and how I've come to a realization over the years through education, through self-reflection, and, you know, through just personal honesty and accountability, that, you know, I had to change my attitudes and I had to change some of my behaviors. Hmm. And encourage other men to take those kind of steps to move forward, to evolve and to grow and to shift our attitudes and our behaviors. And I think that's a really important thing to do. And I think, you know, just really digging beneath the surface and really trying to get underneath the roots of male violence or physical and sexual violence toward girls and women is a conversation that very rarely happens with boys and men, even to this day. And so to have that conversation out loud and publicly in a room full of men, led by men, can be very powerful. It can be a very powerful experience.
Quentin, it seems like we have a really great opportunity right now to talk about these issues and go a lot deeper. I mean, these are massive issues. When I brought up the question, how do you talk to men and boys about things like sexism, anger, rejection, objectification? I mean, these are massive issues. But I mean, we got calls from men last week who said, yeah, I'm angry. You know, some men emailed me and said, I have a hard time getting a girl and I'm angry about it. I mean, these are real issues that, you know, we don't want to just scratch the surface. We do want to go deep. So how can we really, you know, capitalize on this moment and make sure it doesn't just disappear in a couple weeks, because this stuff is just so important.
Yeah, and I think, this is a tragic event, and there's so many tragic events, but I think we need to kind of step back, and I think what both Jackson and Byron mentioned is, really creating spaces to even have these conversations, because a lot of times it may be, when I was growing up, I was socialized by my peers, and we really didn't have a lot of good information, so I think it's important that, different male figures and positive male figures, because there's a misconception that young people, or young boys in particular, don't have male figures in their lives. But it's the reality is that we are gravitated to the most consistent and the ones who really kind of reach out to us. So if that is negative, people who demonstrate negative behavior, that's what we go towards. And if that is our peers, then that's what we have to kind of work with. So I think it's important that we create the spaces, number one, the safe spaces to really have these conversations and this dialogue, and then not only necessarily be reactionary around it, really be preventive in our nature. So when we're talking about with young people and young men and boys in particular, is really talking about the things that interest them, and then also tying that into violence against women and girls and other men and boys as well. And we have to really break down what socialization is and how it works, and using tools like Tough Guys from Jackson and Beyond Beats and Rhymes and I'm a Man from Byron, using the tools that are available to us to really, have these conversations. Because that's what was proven effective for our work here in New York City, is to really use pop culture and creative ways of having these dialogues, and not necessarily talking about violence against women automatically, but all the things that kind of lead up to those attitudes and those belief systems and that behavior. So really being creative around the conversations that we have, I think that's important, and getting their buy-in. So they may not necessarily want to talk about their role in violence against women, but they may want to talk about women and girls, right? And how do you engage and talk to someone? Because, Elliot Rogers' case was really, could really break down from sexual harassment and part of a continuum of violence against women. So really, how do you engage, how do you have conversations with the opposite sex? And then even how do we have conversations amongst, adults and youth? Part of that is the difficulty as well, that older people are scared to have these conversations with young people. Mm-hmm. Young people don't respect older people. So it's really, really creating safe environments, and then really having different types of men in front of young men, so they can see the different forms of masculinity that they can draw from. Mm-hmm. So they're not kind of pigeon-toed into one form of masculinity that might be very unhealthy.
And to that point, Jackson, you point out that boys are so traumatized by violent men, whether it's a dad hitting the mom or yelling at the mom, or maybe hearing classmates degrade women and no one says anything about it. But you say that it's so important for us to recognize that, and also talk about the fact that male victims of violence are the victims of other men's violence, and it's just this sort of ugly cycle. How can you give us a specific example of how you break that cycle? Like, how do you talk to a young boy who sees maybe his father hitting his mom on a regular basis?
Well, I mean, that's difficult. Those are difficult conversations. I mean, that needs to be a conversation in a therapeutic setting, in a professional setting. I mean, as an educator, as an activist, and I think the three of us, Byron, myself, and Quentin, are all in varying forms educators and activists. When it comes to the individual cases, when a boy is in a traumatic situation, there is a whole another set of circumstances and set of professional considerations. That person needs guidance. They need help. They need support. They need professional assistance. I think what's important that the rest of us can do in those kind of situations is to show is to create the social norms change, where in a school, in a community, in whatever institutional or community setting we have access to, is to make it clear that that's not acceptable behavior, that it's not okay that you're experiencing that behavior as a boy. In other words, boys and men need to hear from other men as well as from women and people in positions of authority that they respect, that kind of behavior, violence, and the abuse that you're suffering is not okay, it's not your fault, and that this person, the person who's doing it, has a problem and needs help and needs support and sometimes needs accountability. But I think the change, Rose, has to be systematic. It can't just be about individuals. Because I say over and over again, I give lots and lots of talks, right? I say over and over again that if we're just running from one case to the next of boys or young men who have been being abused or being traumatized by their father abusing their mother or whatever, if we're just running from one case to the next trying to figure out what to say to this kid or what to say or how to intervene in that situation or this situation, it's hopeless in a world of 8 billion people when these problems are so systematic. We have to have institutional and macro responses to institutional and macro problems. So as an educator, my role and my goal is this stuff needs to be in schools. It needs to be at the age-appropriate level, in K through 12. It's certainly in every high school in the United States, these conversations, like the MVP program, our approach, you know, Byron and I developed back in the early 90s, that should be in every school in the United States. Kids, boys and girls, should have the opportunity to talk to other boys and girls and men and women and be guided in discussions about sex and violence and relationships and healthy, you know, masculinity, healthy femininity, and media, bring media literacy into it. And then boys and young men who are in situations of violence, whether it's in their families or in their, you know, their peer cultures, will have a different way of thinking about that violence. They won't think it's just normal or acceptable. They'll think it's they'll be hearing from others, both professional and their peers, that this kind of behavior is not cool. It's not acceptable. Some kids have problems, and they buy into some of these narrow definitions of masculinity and femininity, and yet, and they might be caught up and stuck in these situations. But that there is hope because there's a new way of thinking about this that brings everybody into the solution stage.
So, talking about the systematic problem and the fact that we really need to address the institutions that allow for this behavior, Byron, you served as an associate director of the first gender violence prevention program in the U.S. Marine Corps. We've done a lot of shows about sexual assault and rape in the military. The Pentagon estimates there were 26,000 cases of unwanted sexual contact in 2012, but so many people say they are not reporting it for fear of retaliation. So, for example, how do you talk to soldiers about these issues?
Well, you talk to them. I mean, you talk to them, and what you really have to do is what Jackson mentioned earlier is reaching men of influence and authority who have positions of power within those institutions to co-sign and to send the message to other men in the other men and women in the military that this is a priority issue that needs to be addressed, that is going to be addressed, and that it should be taken seriously. And, you know, again, Jackson and I have done a lot of work, in addition to other men like Jeff O'Brien and Darryl Ford and others, in the military, the Marine Corps, the Army, the Air Force, the Coast Guard. Jackson could elaborate on all of the work that has been done within the U.S. military, but the focus there has been trying to implement and institutionalize the MVP philosophy, the pedagogy, the style of leadership, to begin to change the culture within the military and to get people to take rape and sexual assault very seriously, and to use the leadership within those institutions to change the culture. And that is something that doesn't happen overnight. It's something that happens over time, incrementally, but it will never happen without the leadership and without the co-signing of this type of physical and sexual violence prevention training by the men who have power within those institutions. And that's the most significant thing, is getting men with power to buy in so that they can send the message that this is important and it's not going to be tolerated, and there has to be some sort of cultural shift. And that just begins with a tremendous amount of leadership and change in direction.
Byron Hurt is an award-winning documentary filmmaker and writer, a former Northeastern University football quarterback. He's founding member of the Mentors and Violence Prevention Program. His documentary films include I Am a Man, Black Masculinity in America, and Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes. His next film is called Hazing, How Badly Do You Want In? We're also joined by Jackson Katz, co-founder of the Mentors and Violence Prevention Program, and he's author of The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men can help. We're also joined today by Quentin Walcott, co-executive director of Connect NYC, an organization dedicated to eliminating family violence. He spent 18 years addressing a critical part of the equation to ending violence against women, and that is men. And on today's Your Call, we are talking with men about misogyny and violence against women. And we'd love to hear from you. We got so many phone calls from you last week when we did two shows about this. And if you're thinking about these issues, about just anger, about rejection, about how men deal with the objectification of women and pornography, I mean, these are really big questions, but we really need to address them. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. If you work in a group with women and men on these specific issues, what do you think is most effective to go deeper? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Excuse me, if you're an educator or a mentor who works with boys or young men, how do you talk to them about these issues? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Let's hear from Linda in Santa Cruz. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I really appreciate the show and all the men you have on. You are heroes, and I give you accolades for that. And I would like to suggest that the main issue here, I believe, is built on, we could call it maybe spirituality or the law of the land. And I believe we need an amendment to the Constitution so that women are given equal statutory standing in the law. And I believe this sets the precedence for which all else stands. And so this leads me to my next point. 10 years ago, I was assaulted by a man in Santa Cruz. He assaulted other women and a man. And still, the authorities let him go. They didn't impanel a jury in time. But the thing for me, which my life, my body devastated by this assault, but worse was the prosecutor and the judge who treated me like I was a criminal. And this, you know, I thought it's so unmasculine. The men that are in charge of protecting the most vulnerable in our society, women, they attacked me. They used their powers of judicial authority, of district attorney prosecutorial discretion. They used their choices to beat me up. And then I saw them do it to other women when I joined the Domestic Violence Commission, and nobody spoke out about it. And this is the thing. Until the men at the top, and it's mostly men, until they understand truly how to be a man and protect people that are willing to come forward, things will not change. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Linda. And again, Jackson, this goes back to the institutions that allow for this kind of behavior. What are your thoughts on Linda's comments?
Well, I mean, I'm sorry to hear about Linda's experience. I appreciate that there are lots of stories out there. We hear them all the time. And in the work that I do and my colleagues, you know, Byron and Quentin, we hear story after story of women and men who have been, you know, victims of violence, who are big victims of systemic indifference or worse. I mean, the problems are wide and deep. I appreciate that. I mean, I think one thing, Rose, you had mentioned a moment ago about issues relating to, you know, sex and rejection and pornography.
Jackson, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking with a roundtable of men about misogyny and violence against women, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, a show that relies on and encourages engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-8255. Or you can send a question or comment to our email inbox. The address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say. At noon today, it's Bina, Creative Voices from the Jewish Community Center here in San Francisco, and at 1, David LaTulipe and Open Air.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we'll talk about media coverage of James Risen, the New York Times journalist who could face jail time for not revealing his sources. We'll also talk about the recent right-wing gains in the EU elections. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are continuing the conversation we've been having about misogyny and violence against women in light of the tragedy that happened a few weeks ago in Santa Barbara involving a 22-year-old Elliot Rodger killing six people. He left a misogynistic manifesto, 140-page manifesto, along with a number of YouTube videos. We got a lot of attention on this issue last week. We don't want it to die down, so we decided to have a conversation with a panel of men who are standing up and speaking out. And we're joined by Byron Hurt, an award-winning documentary filmmaker, founding member of the Mentors and Violence Prevention Program. His films include I'm a Man, Black Masculinity in America, and Hip Hop, Beyond Beats and Rhymes. Quentin Walcott is co-executive director of Connect NYC, an organization dedicated to eliminating family violence. And Jackson Katz is co-founder of the Mentors and Violence Prevention Program and author of The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help. And before the break, Jackson, you were responding to Linda's question about the institutions that allow for this. In her case, a victim of domestic violence, and she felt like she didn't get support from anybody in the system. In fact, they hurt her even more.
Right. And again, I appreciate her story, and I'm sorry that that happened to her and so many other women and men and children who experience both victimization and then perhaps re-victimization at the hands of an insensitive, indifferent, and sometimes hostile system. I mean, one thing I just want to make sure that I say, Rose, in response to like the question of how do you change institutions and how do you change institutional practices. Number one, there has been an ongoing movement over the past 30 or 40 years of men. In a multiracial sense, in this country and an international sense around the world, who have been addressing these very issues. And one of the things that emerged from the Elliot Rodgers, massacre, a killing spree in Isla Vista is this whole conversation online, especially about, what role can men play in this, and is this misogyny that's much more culturally and, sort of socially based, or is it just some individual psychopathic or sociopathic behavior that has to be looked at? And one of the things that's been, I have to say, frustrating to me and many of my colleagues around the country is that a lot of people in these online conversations don't seem to know that there have been men who have already been engaging with these kind of questions in classrooms, in workshops, in community organizations like Q's and the MVP program, Mentors and Violence Prevention Program, in schools, in the military, in sports culture, for decades and decades. The problem hasn't been that we don't have men who are interested in and want to engage in the conversation. The problem is, how do you scale it up and make it institutional practice on a much broader level, on a much broader scale? An example of that is, for example, pornography is such a hugely influential industry in shaping sexual norms in this society, right? When Elliot Rodgers, I saw the Elliot Rodgers videotape of him talking, one of his self-produced videotapes, talking about how his anger towards women for sexually rejecting him. The mainstream of heterosexual pornography features men's aggression towards women. The anger expressed verbally and physically and sexually towards women is the mainstream of the pornography culture. In other words, the anger at women for rejecting them, the fact that women operate in pornography and heterosexual pornography in scripts where they're completely subservient to men's will and dominance, is all of this has to be part of the conversation. And yet in schools throughout the United States, there's so little sex education, there's so little honest conversation about this kind of stuff. And so in the absence of a public conversation, an educational safe space, where an opportunity for men and women, boys and girls, to have honest dialogues about these kind of issues, you have the private market rushes in the pornography industry's case, and that they're socializing our children. So part of the educational response to this private market's sort of exploitation of our children and of adults has to be having constructive educational intervention, and yet that's a decision that has to be made at the policy level by educational policymakers, superintendents of school districts, school boards, principals of schools, teachers. If we're going to focus on the kids, I mean, the kids aren't making the decisions about what's the educational programming, what's the opportunities to talk about this and dialogue about this. The kids aren't doing that. The adults need to do that. And I think that's what we're talking about when we say institutional change. And one last point, I don't think we need to be going to educational administrators and political figures and asking them for help. I think we need to start saying we expect this of them. And in a democratic society, we are going to hold them accountable because we're authorizing them to act in our name as administrators, as political leaders, as community leaders. And if they're not responsive, in other words, if they're not putting in place the programming, the focus, the institutional sort of leadership, then we're going to pressure them to do so, or we're going to replace them. That's how democracy works. We can't just go hat in hand hoping that they're going to help us out. I think that's a failed model, and I think the model over the last 25, 30 years of women in organizations like schools and other places, they have so much knowledge about sexual violence, about relationships, about abuse in the home and how it spills over into, you know, dysfunctional behavior and abusive behavior in schools and bad success, you know, bad outcomes, educational outcomes in schools. The women who know all this, they often don't have the institutional power to make the changes in the school climate because they're not the principal, they're not the superintendent, they're the sexual assault counselor, and they're the ones who, or the prevention specialist, they're the ones who go to the principal, the superintendent, and say, can we have more money for this program, or could you support this or that? And the superintendent or the principal or the other leader can say yes or no, but they can just walk away if they say, you know, we have other priorities. That's the model that has to change. We can't just be asking for them to be participating. We need to say we expect it, and we're going to hold you accountable.
We have an email from Anushka who says, thank you for the program. As the mother of a 14-year-old son and 16-year-old daughter, I have thought a lot about my role in how my son turns out as a man. Has research been done on the role of mothers in shaping boys into men? Is there a correlation between men who are violent towards women or violent in general and the way they experience their moms growing up? What are the few things moms might typically get wrong in raising our sons, and what can we do better? Quentin, do you want to address Anushka's question first?
Sure. Yeah, I think part of the realities for us here at Connect in New York City is that we are working with a lot of communities and families that have absent fathers. And, you know, I grew up a product of a single mother as well. And I beg to differ this thought and this notion that, you know, mothers don't know how to raise boys and men in particular, because I think, you know, mothers have been doing a great job playing, you know, both roles in terms of being caretakers and really trying to instill in boys in particular, you know, the things that are important to really be in relationships and how to treat women and girls in general and in relationships. So I think it's important that we recognize and give mothers credit for all the work that they've been doing and stepping up when there has been families where their fathers have been absent. But I would just say that, you know, part of it is really these conversations. You know, I think adults need to really be in conversation with young boys and girls in particular about, you know, what does it mean? What does manhood mean? What does womanhood mean? What does it mean to you know, what are the attitudes, what are the challenges in society that really create negative examples in terms of media, really having conversations with young people when they see something on TV or in a movie, to really kind of break that down and how does that show up. And I think one of the main things, too, is that we really need to create critical thinkers of our young people so that they can make informed choices and challenge things that they feel are incorrect. When we first started our work in Brooklyn, we did focus groups with young men, single-gender groups with young men and with young girls, and we really kind of really asked them questions about how did you develop your thinking about what it means to be a boy and what about being a man and what a woman is and what a girl is. And so a lot of that was really developed by TV, socialized in barbershops. You know, and like, you know, Byron and Jackson are mentioning is that even if you have a young person who is really, you know, thinks about gender equity and gender justice, everything, the supporting systems around them can be very challenging if you think a certain way. So many things need to be done. We need to work on an individual level, relationship level, community level, and a systemic level. All those things need to kind of be working in place to really, you know, really encourage her, to put her in a position where she can raise her child, you know, male or female, to really be thinking about equality and mutuality in terms of gender and in relationships. Mm-hmm. So I think really creating, you know, communities that are having these conversations, because, you know, I mean, I first started doing this work strictly with young people, and, you know, that's the prevention model, work with young people and they'll grow up and become and save the world and correct all the mistakes that we made as adults. But the reality is that young people don't have the power, you know, to really change those systems that Jackson and Byron are talking about. So we have to really work with the adults in their lives so they can change and therefore, you know, be that example for these young people around making decisions around relationships in terms of gender equality and what have you. So I think that's important too, you know, working with them individually, supporting parents, giving them the tools to really, you know, engage in conversations with young people and be examples for them. And also young people seeing what the process of change of these structures, because if you treat a young girl differently in high school than you treat the young man, then that tells a story. So in terms of, Linda mentioned, in terms of, you know, being re-victimized by the system, that tells a story as well. So the communities that I work in, many of them are undocumented, so they're not going to the police or they're not going to the court systems because they're fearful of being deported and then re-victimized and being blamed for the abuse that they're receiving. So I think it's important that, you know, we develop these support systems and really create, you know, critical thinking. That I think that's really important.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the email, Anushka. That is Quentin Walcott, co-executive director of Connect NYC, an organization dedicated to eliminating family violence. Jackson Katz is co-founder of the Mentors and Violence Prevention Program, author of The Macho Paradox, and Byron Hurt is founding member of the Mentors and Violence Prevention Program. And his documentary films include I Am a Man, Black Masculinity in America, and Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes. And since we are trying to have a deeper conversation, I'd love to hear from you, specifically men, if you'd like to talk about how your views of women have been shaped by media images, pornography, just the things that you see on a regular basis, what you grew up with. We'd love to hear from you. And then how have maybe those views transformed from when you were younger? Did someone have an influence on you, or did something, maybe a class you took, have an influence on you? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, or even if you just want to talk about how it affects you today, I think it would be really helpful to hear your perspective. And then also, if you work with a group that deals with these issues, what is most effective and how do you go about talking about these issues? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Meg in Salinas. Hi, Meg. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose, and good morning to your panel. Thanks for your continued covering of this particular topic. You know, I wanted to speak on, I wanted to talk about the problem that young people today get. Well, as far as the conflicting messages, there are conflicting messages that come out of the religious sector that has, you know, the image of God being a male, and then the and also that you must follow a man, that a woman is to basically be led by a man, and, well, all these religious messages. And I can tell you that in positions that I've had of leadership or things that I've been involved in, I've often had difficulties with other women who tend to coalesce around men as leaders and sort of put another woman who is a leader or doing something in a leading capacity out in the cold. And they sort of, you know, they follow almost like little harems. I don't know any other way to put it. And so I've come across this in areas of leadership. But I think that it isn't so much with the younger generation, but I do feel that the younger generation of women are getting conflicting messages. Mm. They've got the old conflicting message of that men are in charge and you are to follow a man's example or lead. And then they also have these images out in the pop culture, which have people like, you know, for example, Beyonce out there, you know, dressing the way that she does.
Yeah.
I just think that when it comes to etiquette, some of that is sorely lacking. But I really also believe that women also are contributing to some of the problems, sad as it may be.
Well, thank you. I mean, gosh, that we could do a whole show on that and just how things have changed in one generation, right? I mean, Byron, this is a really interesting point. I mean, a generation ago, most women got married at 20, had a child at 21, and that was it, right? And maybe stayed with a man they weren't happy with. Now you can be 40, single, and child-free, and it's just not a big deal. So things have changed so quickly in one generation. And do you focus on how that has affected men?
Well, women are more empowered today than they were back in the day.
Yeah.
And, you know, the women's rights movement and women who pushed back against many of the social inequality that they face, whether it was in the workplace or in education or, you know, in terms of physical and sexual and emotional abuse, you know, women have gained a tremendous amount of rights in this country that they did not enjoy previously. And so as a result, there are many men in our culture and our society who are pushing back against that mm-hmm. and trying to reclaim their position, their sense of entitlement, their sense of male privilege, to regain that sense of control and power over girls and women. And so we can see that being played out through religion. I'm not a religious scholar, but there's no question that the church, in most cases globally, is highly patriarchal, where women don't have an equal amount of power as men in church. In fact, you know, women leadership or female leadership in the church is something that is not welcomed in the church and in other places as well. And so, you know, patriarchy is deeply embedded in the culture that we live in. And when women push back against it and challenge it and as a result receive the benefits of a lot of their own leadership and a lot of their own activism, men push back against that. And so, you know, it creates a tremendous amount of, I guess, inner crisis or inner insecurity on the part of a lot of men. And I think that's what we see happening with a lot of young boys and older men acting out against girls and women violently.
Well, thank you again for the phone call. We've got a number of people on the line, so I'll take a few callers in a row and then we'll get responses. Let's go to Richard calling from Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Laura.
Oh, sorry about that. Bad line. Richard wanted to talk about what men can do, which we were talking about throughout the hour. Thank you. Sorry about that, Richard. Let's go to Phil in Brisbane. Hi, Phil.
Hi. I would like to agree with the guest who said that the degradation...
Are we having
pornography
phone?
Today.
There you go.
And
Can you repeat
can you
that? Sorry. Go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I would like to agree with the guest who said very eloquently that degradation of women has become the norm in pornography, and it's a horrifying example for young people. However, my question is this. First Amendment issues aside, the porn industry today offers up things like Real Rape, is the name of one website, mm-hmm. as well as a lot of child pornography and other deviant behavior, which can be destructive. And my question is, are the providers, the Googles and the Yahoos, as well as the other filmmakers involved, are they not as culpable in this issue as the people that get arrested for downloading these films?
All right. Well, I'll get that to that in just a couple minutes. I'm going to take a few more calls. Really important question. Thank you. Let's hear from Richard is back in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Richard.
Hello again. We're clear?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, wonderful. Yes, thank you for the show. Good to hear everybody's input. So I will share from, first a pitfall from organizing with men that I've noticed is that I'm trying to figure out how to work around the problem when, if men are doing this work, that I've come across where men use that as a label to say, hey, I'm doing this really feminist, awesome, anti-patriarchal work, and then cause harm in a dating scenario, and kind of using that. So I'm trying to figure out how to circumvent that, so it's not used as something to cause more harm in doing supposedly doing anti-patriarchal work and counter-organizing. What I have noticed does work is in terms of sexual countering sexual violence programming in boys is bystander intervention. And that bystander intervention actually works better than doing quote-unquote anti-rape programming because anti-rape workshops tend to approach boys and men as if they're innate rapists. They're just rapists waiting to happen, and so there's resistance against that. But bystander intervention approaches with the assumption that if you saw sexual violence going down as a man or a boy, you would intervene. And that ends up being much more successful, and most of the boys and men who go through bystanders.
Richard, sorry to cut you off. We're almost out of time. Do you have a specific question? Because you're raising a lot of issues there that are tough to tackle in a minute.
Okay, yeah. So I just wanted to say bystander intervention is very effective in helping boys and men not be sexually violent and be sexually patriarchal in a dating circumstance.
Got it. Okay, thank you so much. We'll address it in a minute. Let's hear from Raman in Oakland. Hi, Raman.
I went to high school here in the Bay Area, and drug culture was very pervasive, and I was thinking maybe one quick solution would be to tell boys that it doesn't matter the size of your genitalia. There's too much emphasis on genital size and what's important is how much love you got in your heart. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Raman was talking about jock culture. Phil had a question about porn and whether the internet providers are culpable. But before we get to that, Quentin, you know, what's interesting about porn is that the feminist community hasn't really talked much about porn in the last few weeks. And a few women who write about porn have said we need to have this conversation, even though so many people, including people on the left, progressives, you know, don't really want to go there. What are your thoughts on that? And how do you deal with porn in the work that you do?
Well, I mean, we live in porn and rape culture, so it's really, you know, it's always part of the conversation. And it's almost becoming invisibilized. I think that's what happens when we look at, you know, violence against women, violence against any marginalized group. You know, it becomes just kind of almost normalized that exists and it happens that way. I think one important thing is, you know, for anyone who's involved in or at any level of that industry, is that you know violence against women and girls is profitable. You know, not just in a monetary sense, but, you know, people look at it that way as well, but also in terms of profitable in the sense of, you know, people who have low, not for all, but for some people who have low self-esteem, low self-value and worth, that, you know, looking at breaking someone else down to build yourself up is part of that process. But all you really do is really, you remain with low self-esteem, and the other person, you just kind of chipped away at their low self-esteem and value just in terms of that. So it has a profit in that way as well. But, you know, you have to really kind of understand that, you know, and I think, you know, Byron's film Beyond Beats and Rhymes also looks at hip-hop as an industry that's very profitable as well. And then, you know, so if you look at, you know, gender, you know, violence against youth is very, you know, profitable as well, and it's connected to other industries and complexes in terms of prisons, and, you know, so the lack of response to many of these injustices is really profitable in some sense. So I think if we look at it in that way, and everybody's culpable to an extent, but I think, you know, we're kind of born into this, so we're socialized. Men and women are socialized in the same ways. So in terms of that faith question, we do a lot of work in faith community. It's in a very difficult community to do the work in, but many of the models of masculinity that we have come from books of faith in terms of God and who religious leaders are. So we have to counter that and really, be able to challenge that in the same way, but respecting, you know, people's faith traditions, but really looking at it and challenging it in ways that can really, you know, move towards safety and really holding someone accountable, because faith communities can do that.
We've got about a minute left. Jackson, I mean, you're dedicating your life to these issues. We've got an opportunity at a time when the word misogyny is in mainstream news headlines. Where do you want this conversation to go, and, you know, what can we do to make sure it doesn't disappear in the mainstream, I should say?
Thank you, Rose. I think we just need the much more passionate engagement and involvement of men at all levels in our society and around the world. And, you know, racially diverse groups of men, culturally diverse, you know, class diverse groups of men need to be partnering with women as our friends and partners and allies in this, not as our antagonists. I think one of the things we need to do is connect the issues of sexual violence and men's violence against women to men's violence against other men, Quentin mentioned this at the beginning. This is part of the work that we do in the MVP program. In other words, gay bashing and bullying and violence that men engage in against each other comes out of the same system that produces men who abuse women and sexually violate women. It's not one or the other. I care, and all of us care about men as victims as well, and men, you know, boys as victims as well. So it's not just about caring about women. It's about caring about men and women. That's one way to engage, you know, more men. I wanted to just quickly say about your comment about porn. Being anti, I think there's a lot of people who don't want to talk about porn, in part because they see that because they see the idea that somehow if you're critiquing porn, you're somehow anti-sex or you're anti-sexual empowerment, which is ridiculous. It's the opposite of the truth. If you believe in sexual empowerment for women and for men, you would be against the porn industry, which is completely sexist and degrading towards women and men. And also, I want to say about Richard's comment about the bystander approach. I mean, I'm one of the architects of the bystander approach. MVP is the first bystander program. I 100% agree with Richard that we need to be building in the bystander approach to the educational process at all levels and engaging men and boys who will say, I don't rape women, I don't abuse women, this isn't my problem. What we say in the bystander approach is, yes, it is your problem, it's all of our problem. We all have a responsibility to our peers, to our peer culture, to our communities, and guys who are not abusive need to start speaking up and challenging other guys around them, and not just 16-year-old boys or 20-year-old college students, but powerful corporate executives. And one thing about your, you know, domain in Silicon Valley, in the San Francisco sort of general area, there's so many powerful men who have economic resources, technological prowess. We need to engage those men in figuring out ways to use their privileges and their advantages to expand this conversation, both here in the United States and globally. There's roles for men at all levels in this work.
Well, we will definitely continue this conversation. Jackson Katz is co-founder of Mentors in Violence Prevention and author of The Macho Paradox. Byron Hurt is a documentary filmmaker. Films include I Am a Man, and Quentin Walcott is co-executive director of Connect NYC. And thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss media coverage of James Risen, the New York Times journalist who could face jail time for not revealing his sources. What does his case mean for press freedom and whistleblowers? We'll also talk about the recent right-wing gains in the EU elections. We'll be joined by the Contra Costa Times' Thomas Peel, freelance journalist Marcy Wheeler, and the New Statesman's Philip Kleinfeld. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar. And you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.